I did have like a like a premeditated intro, but I always think they sound so fabricated and I would end up butchering it. But in short, Andrew is a serial entrepreneur. For the longest time has worked in marketing and PR services. Has recently sort of founded his own consultancy, I believe, for the past 2 years. And yeah, someone who I think from afar I can learn a ton from. I think from like a from an audience perspective, Andrew worked with Lord Sugar, I think, for the best part of 15 or 20 years, working with some of the winners of The Apprentice. So I bet some really interesting stories there, but I'm more, I guess, concerned or interested in, first, how everything got started, Andrew. I love deep diving into the origin story of my guests and understanding, I guess, what brought them to where they are. So I'd love to understand a bit about you, Andrew, where you're from, and we can get going from there.
Of course. Well, I'll keep the origin story brief, but... essentially, when I was at school and university, I didn't really know particularly what I wanted to do. And I had an art teacher who once said to me, I think you'd be good in advertising. And to be honest, no one had ever told me I'd be good at anything. So I clung on to that idea throughout school. And I did management at university in Manchester. And I just sort of, when I was finishing up university, I'd done a few work placements in ad agencies and stuff. So, and I thought, this is for me. Cutting a long story short.
So you watched Mad Men and you were told?
I think I'm a bit older than that. So Mad Men, I'm not sure, had been released at the time. I've watched it since. But yeah, this was 1995, something like that. Anyway, to get into advertising is tough. I mean, as with any career, really. But very, very rigorous interview process and selection process, several stages, and it was just I just wanted to work. I was really hungry to work, and I was getting a bit despondent, frustrated, and someone said to me, my mum claims it was her, so we'll go with that, why don't you try PR? You know, it's similar. So I wrote to a load of different PR agencies. I ended up at an agency called Lynn Franks, which was a phenomenal agency. It was the agency that Absolutely Fabulous was based on, pretty crazy place. And I fell in love with it from day one. It had all the aspects of advertising that I was attracted to, the creativity and the diversity of working with different clients, but the pace was fast and it was, I was addicted to the adrenaline of sort of coming up with creative ideas and then seeing them appear in the media the next day, the next week. I loved it. So, I stayed with the agency for a few years. It got acquired by a big global agency called Ketchum. Ended up sort of head of sport and entertainment, living the dream, really. Every young man, would love to be working on the stuff I was working with. I was working with the England football team, looking after all of Carlsberg's sponsorship. I was working with Liverpool. I was working with, all sorts of things. I mean, it was amazing. And then my former MD from Lynn Frank said, do you want to set up a PR agency? And I was a bit like, I don't think I'm ready. I've only really been doing this for five and a half years. Like, give me a few more years.
Yeah.
And he said something that I will never, ever forget was, you'll never feel ready and let's just do it. And I guess my thought process, which might feel a bit negative, but was sort of what's the worst that can happen? And I went through this thought process of the worst that can happen, which was essentially, give it a go, it won't work, and I'll go back cap in hand to my old employer, or I'll be, find another job in PR. That was sort of the worst case. And I was still, single. I can't remember if I was living at home, but it felt like, the risk was probably as low as it was ever going to be at any period in my life.
It was a free shot goal, basically.
Just gave it a go. And I never, ever envisioned that it would turn out. I mean, honestly, it wasn't survival. That sounds really depressing. But I'd never sort of visualised where it could go. As far as I was concerned, I just wanted to stay in this role and make something of it. But, over the course of many years, we built the company up to become one of the most famous PR agencies in the world, really, and we're privileged enough to work on hundreds of amazing award-winning campaigns and loved every second of it. And then sort of fast forward to 4 years ago, I just had a bit of...
Sorry to interject there, Andrew. I'm just curious, I'm picking up on something that you said before, which I'm really interested in people, right? There were two things that stood out for me. Number one was you said that you had this like inherent drive to succeed, right? That you wanted to be part of, and you lit up when you were talking about the fast-paced nature of PR and what you were working on. Where do you think that drive came from? Was it your parents? Was it instilled in you from an early age, or were you born with it? Like, where does that come from?
It's a really good question. I think a lot of it does come from my dad, who's not in this industry but is a grafter and had an incredible work ethic, and even now in retirement probably puts some people to shame, just sort of tinkering around with various different business ventures. So I think some of it came from him. But then, you know, my brother, I mean, who's also got a very successful career in a sort of related field, he works in marketing, but is a different character to me. I don't want to say he's not driven or not entrepreneurial, because that's not fair. He's very driven, but he's a real company man. You know, he's a corporate guy. Okay. And we're very different. So I often think, you know, does it come from your parents? You know, the way we approach work, our attitudes are very different. You know, both doing okay, you know, but we are different people. So whether it comes from your parents, I don't know. But I think I never take it for granted that I love what I do, because I do think it's a bit of a blessing to find something that you're good at and that you enjoy. And as you sort of progress, I think in any career, not just in what I was doing, you end up doing less and less of the sort of day job, the bit you started doing. So in my case, that was sort of doing PR, speaking to media, crafting stories, getting things out there. You know, as you rise up the ranks, you end up effectively becoming a finance person, an HR person, a, you know, business person. But I always had this love for creating campaigns and making brands and people famous. I loved it. Like, properly, it was like a drug. And I've always tried throughout my career to stay hands-on and not become too far removed from the business of what we're actually doing and how we're actually making money. And I think that stood me in quite good stead, because not everyone does love doing, you know, they get into the sort of senior stages of their career and they're quite happy to leave behind that day job. I mean, on the flip side, there's other people that do the job and never very good at the more senior aspects of building a company. And so I always loved that bit, and I've always tried to, it's not everything I do and I don't do it as much as I used to, but stay close to creativity. And I think that's important, because especially now in this stage of my career where, you know, I'm largely consulting and advising other firms, being able to still be at the coalface of what needs to be done and what they're doing day to day, I think gives you the edge from someone that's perhaps, you know, very qualified as a business person but hasn't necessarily got the same grip on what's going on in the industry and things that are happening day to day.
And they're a bit far removed from the action, basically.
Yeah, I think, you know, it all comes from understanding how to tell a good story and how to create a campaign. So I want to, if required, you know, I can do that. I don't do as much of it as I used to, but I've never stepped back to the level where if someone asked me to do it, I wouldn't know what I was doing. And I do enjoy doing it. So sometimes it's quite nice to get stuck in and actually be at the coalface. But as I said, I don't do that very much. It would take up too much time, but I can do it if required.
Fair. And look, I definitely want to focus this conversation more, I guess, the what you're doing now in the future. But as a recruitment entrepreneur myself, right, like I've been in sort of many recruitment companies, and scaling professional services is hard, right? Like, yes, you have your product has to be good, your service has to be good, but ultimately you have to scale people, and scaling people is is tricky. It's something that you've managed to do with Frank, and also that I guess you're helping your companies do now in your sort of advisory firm. What, in your experience, Andrew, is the key? Well, I guess it's not what just one particular thing, but what are some like key themes or attribution points you put to being able to scale a people business?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's not easy, and people are tricky. I mean, they're your biggest asset. Without the people, you haven't got a business. I always had a relatively simple vision, and it's so simple that it sounds stupid, but it was just, I want my company to do the best work in the industry. And I knew that if we could do that, everything would follow. You know, if you do the best work, you get noticed, you win the best clients, you scale, you attract the best people because they want to work for the best company doing the best work. So always tried, and not just me, because there was, you know, a senior team, to really just focus on being the best at what we do, because I knew that everything else would become much easier if we did that. And you have to have growth in a company, because without growth, you can't give people the opportunities that they need to fulfill their own aspirations. So focusing on growth and making sure we weren't standing still was very, very important. And I actually think that, you know, if you were standing still, you are going backwards. You have to have this continual growth for people within the company to have that personal development. And then you have to create within the company a structure that gives people a pathway to feel fulfilled. And in the same way I felt fulfilled, every single person had to know where they were and where they could go. And we built the company very much as a meritocracy. And I think it's very easy to be nice to good people and reward good people. It's not so easy to deal with difficult people. And if you treat everyone the same, what then ends up happening is the good people don't excel to the level that they're capable of. The bad people get away with doing a bad job. So to run it as a meritocracy, for me, that was about having an attitude whereby if you were young enough, if you're good enough, you would succeed. It didn't matter how young you were, what level of experience you had. It was all about attitude. Yeah. And I felt that because personally, you know, I was 26 when we started the agency. And I was young, I had imposter syndrome. You know, I used to wear a suit, not because I had to wear a suit, because I thought it made me look a bit more grown up and people would take me a bit more seriously. But I had the opportunity to build something, and my age wasn't a barrier, my experience wasn't a barrier. And I wanted to ensure, and as a culture within the company, wanted to ensure that everyone was able to do that. We structured the company in a way that as it grew, you didn't have to wait for someone to retire or leave or die before you could move into the hot seat. You didn't have to do a certain number of years before you got to the next level. It was all about, here's your job description, here's what we want you to achieve, and once you've demonstrated you've done that, you're ready to get to the next level. And if that took you 6 months instead of 2 years, that wasn't an issue. And that was what running a meritocracy was all about. It also meant you have to be tough. And when people aren't progressing, obviously you try and help them, but not everyone is going to be a star. Not everyone is going to do a great job. And you have to manage those people out of the business. And what happens when you run a meritocracy properly, you're never that sort of overt in terms of you're great, you're not great. But people see others around them that are perhaps younger or have been in the role for less time, progressing at a quicker rate, getting the promotions, getting the pay rises, moving through the ranks. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, sooner or later, probably with a bit of help sometimes, realise they're not going to progress in this company, and then they make a decision to either up their game or leave. But you're, you know, scaling a services business is extremely difficult. And I think in the first place, you've got to attract the right people, and that's through doing the best work. The other thing that, you know, I'm a big fan of is running sort of work placement and internship programs to allow young people to get into the industry, to get their first foot in the door, and essentially see if they like the industry and if you like them. And then if they like the industry, whether they like your company. Because I was very lucky. I sort of fell into an agency by fluke that, with hindsight, I look back and I often think I could not have chosen a better agency in terms of the work they were doing, the culture. It just fitted me perfectly. But as I said, that was luck. I didn't know that. And I started doing an unpaid work placement, and they spotted something in me and gave me the opportunity. And equally, I spotted, I like this industry, I like this company. So we've always, when we were running the company, tried to do that. And that work placement program led to us hiring people that went on to stay with the company for years and years and years, go, you know, rise up. You know, our deputy MD started as a work placement before he went off and then set up his own company, because inevitably when you get young entrepreneurial hungry people, there comes a stage where they do want to spread their wings. And actually, when I look back now, I don't know whether you want to call it a legacy, it feels a bit of a big word to use, but I kind of feel like that's the thing I'm proudest of. I look around in my industry, and at the head of some of the best agencies in the country are people that have worked with me, for me, alongside me. And that's amazing. I mean, that. So yeah, you're a very, very long-winded answer to your question.
No, not at all. I love it. When someone's so passionate about something, I let them run. There's nothing I can say that's going to improve what you're saying at that point. A theme that you ran there, right, which I think is maybe a little bit lost in today's working culture, I think anyway, is that these high-performance cultures or teams that you've described, right, having a meritocracy where only the people who deserve to progress based on their performance do progress. It's in this interesting phase, right, where how do you manage high performance and also create high trust? And I learned the term recently called radical candor, which is essentially the ability to give feedback properly, right? The ability to tell someone that they're not performing well, but not being a dick about it. And I feel like we've gone too far the other way, where we're scared to give feedback and scared to communicate underperformance, to a point that I think is creating a lot of entitlement, especially in the sales teams that I help build as well. So how much attention did you pay to like the leadership style within that business? And to what extent did you just have the culture so right where people inherently knew what the standard was, and they knew themselves if they weren't reaching it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be clear on what someone's objectives are, and they should be black and white. I think sometimes as a leader, you can forget that you understand it in your head, but not necessarily the fact that others get what you mean. So you always have to sort of work with someone to map out what you expect and what you want in black and white. So it's completely tangible and there's no grey area. So it might be a sales target, it might be a results target, whatever it is, you have to be clear on that. And I think, you know, look, the agency that I co-founded was called Frank. It had the name above the door, which gave us a license to be open, honest, no bullshit. One of the things that frustrated me sometimes with my senior management team is they were very good at giving the pay rises and the praise and the champagne when a campaign went well. They weren't so good at delivering the bad news. And I think that's true for everyone. But in my mind, you have to be able to develop people by being frank. And that is about being constructive in your feedback. And I'm not a shouty person. I'm not confrontational, but I'm not afraid to deliver difficult news, hard things, because you have to. And I actually remember one of my directors once saying to me, she'd done a pitch and it wasn't good, and I was like, it was almost so bad I had to calm down before delivering the feedback. But I did, I sat down with her, spent a lot of time, and she said to me afterwards, that was the most sort of brutal but brilliant feedback I've ever had. And it's always sort of stuck with me. I don't really like the brutal bit, but I'll take the brilliant bit. But the point is, if you don't sit down with someone afterwards in that sort of situation, how are they ever going to know what they've done wrong? And you do have to be constructive. Otherwise, you know, I'm a big fan of sort of pulling people up rather than pushing them down. And I'm also a believer that not everyone is perfect. There is no such thing as the perfect person. People are always going to have their strengths and their weaknesses. So for me, the key was make sure people have got a basic level of competency across everything. You know, you can't have someone that can't write or can't speak. There has to be a level where they can tick a box. But if someone is a brilliant, I don't know, salesperson, new business person, creative, writer, but they're not so good at financial management or people skills or whatever, pull people up on the skills that they're good at and push them into that direction and partner them with people that have complementary but different skill sets. And then you form sort of units that work. So, you know, I look at that even with the running of our agency when it was running. You know, we, myself, the other founder, you know, we were both okay at everything, but I definitely had my strengths, he definitely had his strengths, and they were different. And that's why we worked together. And I'd often, you know, recognize that with pitch teams when we're pitching for new bits of business. You like pull different personalities together. So you have the extrovert that's full of charisma and charm, and then you partner with someone that is maybe a bit more introvert but very strategic and considered. And, you know, a client can see that immediately. They sort of say, I like that guy, he's great, but is he full of shit? Is he just all mouth? And no, because he's with that girl who, you know, she's the one that stabilizes him and is probably gets all the work done, and he's a million miles an hour, but she's considered. It's about building teams. So, but just getting the sort of areas that someone isn't as naturally strong at, don't keep beating them up at that. If someone is not good at written communication, for example, don't keep beating them up and beating them up. Get them to a level where it's acceptable, but focus on the bit that they're really good at and build that. That was my view. I think sometimes we just live in a bit of a world where it's easier sometimes to criticise what's wrong than recognise what's right and really put the effort into delivering high performance.
I love that you went there, Andrew, because again, another thing that I think is maybe lost in the current workplace anyway is like is the focus on like emotional intelligence and the softer skill set that I think most successful people I've spoken to or try to learn from all possess. There's a level of self-awareness that they have where they know how they communicate. For example, you spoke before, right, about saying you often think something in your head, but and you communicate a certain way, but that doesn't necessarily mean the other person has received it that way. It tells me that you've thought long and hard about how you communicate and how other people receive that information. So how much value do you think emotional intelligence has in the modern business landscape?
Huge value. And I think it's sometimes quite hard to recognize what emotional intelligence actually is. And it definitely, as you progress in a career, as you become more mature, I think your emotional intelligence naturally increases. But some people have got it, some people haven't. Some people don't care. You know, their style of management will be quite ruthless and that's how they run things. Other people are a lot more empathetic. You know, rightly or wrongly, I always used to hire an attitude. For me, it was much more important that someone was hungry with a good attitude versus, I mean, I remember the day we sort of started the company and there, you know, we didn't have any staff. We were looking for our first recruits and we ended up hiring someone with a first from Cambridge. And I was so happy with myself. I do still remember, I think I phoned my dad and I was like, can you believe that like someone that's just got a first at Cambridge has accepted a job and they're going to, and I can't remember what my dad said, probably rolled his eyes and put the phone down. But you know, what ended up happening is they were almost too intelligent for the job. And they were very analytical and they were questioning what we were doing and why we were doing it, to the point where it almost sort of destroyed the creativity in the agency. And the second person we hired after that actually came through on a work placement. They were a chef, a TV chef, like not someone super famous, but coming through the ranks as a TV chef, completely mad, fantastic character, completely unqualified to do PR, but someone, I think it was a friend of a friend, or I can't really remember the connection, that said, this guy sort of is going nowhere, he's got this sort of slot on TV as a chef, but his great communication skills, really sort of a bit crazy. And anyway, we hired him. I mean, he was mad, but brilliant. And he was almost the opposite of the other person, because there was no limits. Like, he would come up with ideas that you'd think, wow. There was like no, almost like a child, like no filter. He hadn't processed all the issues and the problems. And then the skill of the people around him would then sort of bring it down to earth and say, look, you couldn't do that, but maybe if we tweaked it, if we did this, we did that, we've got a great campaign. And that was all about just an attitude and a fearlessness. You know, he didn't question why he was doing what he was doing. He would phone up. You know, the normal process would be you'd have an idea and you'd speak to the relevant sort of journalist on a newspaper or on a TV station. He'd go straight to the editor and you're like, what are you doing? And then I remember when I asked him about it, he was like, well, why wouldn't you go to the boss? Like, what do I want to speak to, like, the reporter? Like, I'll speak to the editor. And it didn't always work. He didn't always get through. But I loved that ambition and that attitude. And
nasty.
You know, so I do think, going back to what you're saying, emotional intelligence is incredibly important. We are a people business, and people by people. It's a complete cliche, but I see a lot of very, very talented people in my industry who perhaps just don't have that emotional intelligence and what comes alongside it to really succeed. And I'd take emotional intelligence over IQ any day of the week.
Interesting. And that's what really stood out to me, actually, about the article that I read that you, I think that was posted about 2 years ago now. I'm not going to sort of directly quote you, but you said something along the lines of that in that piece, which was like, for anyone who knows me, they will know that I'm not a person to self-reflect. Yet for me, a lot of emotional intelligence and self-awareness is about reflection. So I'm really curious to understand, one, why was that the point in your career that you decided to reflect? What came from that sort of internal conversation, and how did that lead you to Andrew Block and Associates?
I think, yeah, when I was talking about self-reflection, it was more, I think the pace of running an agency or any people business, or perhaps any business, is you're always on to the next thing. So if we would win a massive piece of business, but genuinely, you know, there'd be a glass of champagne and then bang, on to the next one. If we lost a piece of business, you know, you brush yourself down, probably have a drink, and then on to the next thing. And the bit about self-reflection was really like, I always felt we were always on a journey. It didn't matter how successful we were. There was always the next thing we wanted to achieve, the next thing. And I just felt like, and it's not a regret at all. Like, perhaps it would have done me better to sort of sometimes just stop and reflect a little bit more on, it was more to do with achievements than anything else. I just never did. And then I came to that moment in my career where I decided that I wanted to step back and do something different. And I was almost forced to reflect. And everyone kept saying to me, wow, 20 years, like, so much to be proud of, da, da, da. And I wasn't being like, it wasn't fake modesty. I hadn't ever really stopped and thought about it. And I think that served me well. Like, and I'm not a complacent person. But in terms of day-to-day self-reflection, yeah, it's something, I don't know if self-reflection is the right term for it, but I do think always about how things could be better, what could be improved, where did it go wrong. but not to the point, you know, where it sort of drags me down into my deepest thoughts. I'm a doer. So when someone says to me, you know, what's your 1 year plan? What's your 5 year plan? I'm like, I don't really have one. It's like, I want to get out of bed every morning and feel happy that I'm going to work. And at the point where I'm not happy and I'm a bit fed up on a Monday morning or can't wait to a Friday night, now that's where I question what I'm doing. But as long as I'm enjoying it, I'm not going to self-reflect. And, you know, I'll just tweak things day by day. And then, you know, there's obviously, when you're running a company, it is important to, whether you do it weekly or monthly or quarterly or annually, to look at your performance and what's worked and what hasn't and think about how to figure it out to improve it. Of course you have to do that, but I'm not a sort of sit behind a spreadsheet person. I think we're in a world of data. There's an information overload. You sometimes can get so blinded by numbers that you don't use your instinct and your common sense just to make some natural changes. And I like people that are analytical, but I also get frustrated when people just don't necessarily use their common sense. They're just playing with numbers. And the truth is, if you manipulate data enough, you can get it to say whatever you want. And I feel like sometimes, as a management style, people do that. They convince themselves they're doing a great job by getting a bar chart to look a certain way, or, you know, whatever it might be. Actually, just be honest with yourself. And when you are reflecting, you've got to be your toughest critic. And you've also got to be your biggest fan, you know, back yourself, but recognise where you can make changes if they're required and if they're not. And, you know, I, again, sort of going back to the days running the company, you know, we were doing really well. We didn't, like, there wasn't that much need to change things. It was always about building and improving, but the company was growing in terms of profit, in terms of client base, in terms of the scale of the campaigns we were doing. There wasn't a lot of room to, or requirement to change things in a major way. It was just making sure we were always top of our game. And going back to what I was saying earlier, continue to do the best work, continue to be recognised by the industry for doing the best work. And then you win the clients, then you make the money, then you attract the best people, then the people stay, then you've got the room to grow. And it all just sort of goes in a virtuous circle. But actually the key point of reflection was the work, because what you mustn't do is kid yourself into thinking you're still great and doing great campaigns when they're not as great as they used to be. Because once the work isn't at the top level, then everything else starts to deteriorate alongside it. And that was when we did have moments of self-reflection, it was normally where a campaign hadn't gone as well as we had hoped, or we'd lost a pitch because someone had better creative campaigns than us. That was when we reflected. And in those moments, again, it wasn't necessarily rip up the rule book. We knew we were good. We just had to dig that bit deeper. It's a bit like a football team when, you know, you lose a couple of games. It doesn't mean you're a shit football team. It just means you've sort of lost your mind a little bit and you have to get back into that zone of winning. And we did have periods of time probably where we didn't deserve to win pitches, but we stepped in with such confidence and self-belief that I think that's infectious. And sometimes we did come out and we'd won it and we're like, how do we manage that? We don't really deserve that, in all honesty.
That last 5 minutes was so valuable for me personally, Andrew. You got no idea. I can tell you a bit more I guess after the podcast about why, but your focus on the customer. I think people who always focus on the customer win, but I love the simplicity of how you talk about, like, not having a 3-5 year, like, for an ambitious person, it can become very crippling to constantly think about, where am I doing the right things now that are going to lead to the success that I want in 3-5 years time? But that can lead to procrastination, not actually doing the thing that's going to get you there in the first place. I actually like that. I love the context now that I've got around that comment around self-reflection. It's more just like, I've got other things to focus on that are going to keep me happy and lead me to a better place.
My biggest critic is myself, and I'm so hard on myself, and to the point where if I take a couple of hours off, I feel guilty. And that's not necessarily a good thing, but I want to be the best I can possibly be. You know, I don't want to go into work and not perform as well as I can. So that's a constant driver. And actually now, in this stage of my career, where I've got the luxury of probably too much work, I'm very, very selective about what clients I take on. And I know that's a privileged position to be in, so I don't take that for granted. But probably my biggest criteria is, can I smash this? Because I don't need a client that in 2 months is going to be disappointed with me or say that I haven't made a difference to their business. Or, you know, I want a happy client. And so therefore, when I am choosing, it's not the only criteria, but right at the top is, you know, am I confident that I can do a brilliant job? And I turn down things that, you know, arguably I probably could do, but I don't feel as much self-belief, or I think that's going to be really hard work, maybe I can, I just say yes to the things I know I'll be good at. And that's not meant to sound arrogant, because I'm not good at everything, but I know I'm self-aware in terms of my own ability, strengths and my weaknesses, so I take on the things I know I'm, and you know, that's, I've seen it. I mean, I've been running Andrew Block and Associates for 4 years. I actually feel like I shouldn't say this now because it's tempting fate, but I'm putting my hand on wood and saying I haven't lost a client, haven't had a complaint, haven't had so much as a disappointing conversation. And that is really because I've self-selected the stuff that I'm working on. So I'm setting myself up to succeed. And sometimes when you are running a business, you don't have that luxury, and you have to, you know, I hear lots of entrepreneurs saying, you know, say yes and figure it out later. And I think Richard Branson said that, so far be it from me to criticise Richard Branson. I wouldn't be as arrogant or stupid to do that. But personally, I don't believe that. You know, yes, you can figure stuff out, and, you know, he probably meant it in a slightly different context. But for me, I won't say yes and figure it out later. I'll say yes when I know that I'll back myself to do it. And say no when I'm not.
And to tell me about Andrew Block and Associates, Andrew, tell me about the formation of that company, what you intended to do with it, and where you're at now.
Sure. So when I made the decision to step back from my agency, which wasn't an easy decision, to be honest, but I had a bit of an entrepreneurial itch, and going back to sort of knowing what you're good at and what you're not good at, I knew what I didn't enjoy and what I wasn't that good at. And that was really the people side of things, and the HR and the admin and the process. What I loved was doing the work, and that's what I was good at. So I wanted to set something up in a different way. And Andrew Block and Associates, the associates bit about it, is being able to work with the best people in the industry without actually having to hire them. I have what is essentially a portfolio career. So there's a few main arms to it. I do a lot of M&A work, so buying and selling marketing services companies. And I do that in conjunction with a firm called PCB Partners. And that is using my skill set and my network to find the best companies out there to either be acquired or to help others make acquisitions. I then work with a management consultancy that specialises in marketing services called AAR. And for them, I run their PR, social media, digital content practice. I help clients figure out their marketing infrastructure ecosystem. So what agencies they should be using. I run selection processes for them. I then sit on the board of about half a dozen different marketing services companies. Some of them I invest in. The most recent one that I've done is, it's a group of companies called Stacked, and it's got within it a creative PR agency, a social media agency, a web design agency, and then a platform that will link pre-vetted PR freelancers with brands that don't necessarily need an agency. And you can either work individually or you stack them up to provide everything you need in one place. I work with a kind of couple of other PR agencies, marketing agencies, talent agencies. So that's another part of my portfolio. I still look after Lord Sugar. I think you said 15 years. It's been 24 years now. So I look after him, all of his business interests. I look after the apprentice winners and help set up their businesses from a marketing perspective, actually off this afternoon to record the final of The Apprentice. I know who the winner is, but sort of find out what with the winner. So that's a great part of what I do. And then I did set myself this sort of objective when I set it up to spend 20% of my time sort of giving back, I guess, to the industry that's given so much to me. So I try to spend, I don't know if it's 20%, sometimes it's a bit less, sometimes it's all consuming, but working for charities and not-for-profits. I work with the Prince's Trust, work with people like the School of Communication Arts, which is the most awarded ad school in the world, School of Marketing, sit on various different charities like Variety, the children's charity, or Grief Encounter, which is an incredible charity that's set up to help bereaved parents, families with grief, which I love doing. I find it very rewarding. And it's not easy to explain what I do succinctly.
No, but it feels creative, Andrew. You mentioned before about like the chef here you hired is this sort of like pure, raw individual, right? And that came out in his work. And it feels like that's potentially what you found in Andrew Block and Associates, is this like varied work of stuff that you, of only stuff that you're interested in doing. It seems very like maybe hard to describe what you do, but it also seems like it's just completely aligned with your creative output.
Yeah, I'm doing what I enjoy doing and what I'm good at, and I am enjoying it. It's. I think in your career, you always need to feel like you're pushing yourself a little bit to have that drive and that energy. I'm not a normal person, you know. I love work, and I recognise that not everyone does. I don't know whether I'd call myself a workaholic. Other people definitely would. But from my perspective, I'm doing what I enjoy. And, you know, for me, I don't know whether work-life balance, it's not really I've never figured out what the right term is. But for me, it's like, how do I live my life? And work is a big part of that. But I've given myself, I think, the luxury to, if I want to spend an afternoon playing football, seeing my kids, doing whatever I can, and then I'll come back and I'll probably do a few hours in the evening to sort of make up for the afternoon off. And I've built myself, you know, a business that allows me to do that. And we are in a world where you don't always have to be in an office in the centre of town, and you know, you can do stuff from behind your desk on your phone, and I do. And that, I'd like to be a bit better at it. I always feel like I'm constantly sort of juggling or spinning sort of work, girlfriend, kids, family, you know, and I don't know if it's a me thing, but I never feel like everyone's happy. There's always, and it's normally, as I said, I'm my own toughest sort of judge. That's why I didn't really want to have staff, because I didn't want to feel responsible for them. And I wanted the independence to do stuff on my own, but work with the very, very best people in their industry. And again, going back to sort of recognising your strengths, I recognised that one of my strengths was my network. And I know I will always have a solution to everything. So I'm not necessarily, you know, if you came to me and said, I've got this challenge, I don't have to make that work with the people that work for me. I will know the best person out there to help you with it, and then I'll work with them to help you achieve what you want to achieve. It's all about just using your network effectively. And that was the idea of the model. And it's, you know, people keep saying to me, well, why don't you hire and you can take on more and you can do more? And I don't want to. I like this. I figured out a way that I can scale this business and grow it without having to do that. And, you know, I think sometimes, especially in people businesses, we get a bit obsessed with, you know, when someone says, how's it going? How's the business? The first thing they say is, yeah, I've got 50 employees and so what?
Vanity metrics.
It is a vanity metric. I was no different. I was so proud when we got to 10 people, to 20 people, to 50, to 100, when we had, you know, I could list off offices around the world. But actually it means F all. It's, you know, if you can run a business that is as profitable and successful with no staff as you can as one with 100 staff, I know what I'd rather be doing. So
yeah, it's such a good point, Andrew. Like, in recruitment as well, we've all just sort of like fall into this like trap almost of like, if someone asks you how you're doing, you don't say, oh yeah, we're very profitable this quarter. We say, oh yeah, we've just increased headcount to X, opening offices here, opening a new market, etc. But that doesn't necessarily mean success, right? It could mean that you're losing money. It could mean that you're not enjoying what you're doing anymore. So I think that's really, really, really solid point from you. In professional services business, I think we should more talk about profit or the type of work we're winning as opposed to like the number of heads we're at.
Yeah, that's right. But I think you realise that. I don't know.
Cool.
It's also what's important to you. Like for me, it is about enjoying what I do. This is the sort of next chapter of my career, if you like. So I have different motivations and different objectives. I also, you know, I want to work with nice people. I've got no time for arseholes. It's sort of, I've had the years of, you know, difficult clients. I don't mind demanding clients. They've got a right to be demanding. They're paying, you know, the bills. But I want to work with people I like, I respect, that like me, that respect me. It's about, much more about a partnership than, you know, any successful relationship. You want a partnership. You don't want to feel like a supplier. You don't want them to treat you like a supplier. But never forget your place. You know, I always used to say, running the agency, when people would complain to me about difficult clients or they say, I don't want to work on that. And I said, please don't forget, without these clients, we haven't got an agency, you haven't got a job. So the client is king. But I think now, I don't know if it's a self-attraction. You know, there will be people that don't like my style, that don't want to work with me. But I'm try to be as authentic as I can in the way that I communicate, so that those that do like me, and those that don't. But they know, they get a feeling of who I am. No different when you're running an agency. You've got to have a strong brand with strong values, because that way you will self-select the right sort of clients, and it will lead to longer and more valuable relationships, more enjoyable relationships.
That's exactly what I've taken from you. You've got this very like direct, no bullshit. Yet still quite sensitive and emotionally intelligent, not like brutal as the word you used earlier. And when you do that, like you say, you almost put your stake in the ground. This is who I am. This is what I stand for. This is what I'm passionate about. If this sounds cool to you, then please join me. I'm sure we can partner on something at some point. And you end up surrounding yourself with people who are, you know, passionate, positive, inspiring, and more fun, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And it becomes, you know, in a world where everyone's talking about personal branding and, you know, how should I do this on LinkedIn? How should I do this on Instagram, on TikTok? The first thing I say to anyone is, be yourself. You know, I'm not a fan of people that employ other people to write posts for them. And, you know, you can see it a mile away. You know, if you look at my social media, I mean, it ain't going to win any Cannes Lions or BAFTAs for the production qualities. It's done to my ability as an old man that doesn't really know how to edit and use Photoshop, or, you know, thank God for AI has upped my game a little bit. But it's me. That's who I am. It's my voice. There will never be a word written that someone else has written for me. So I think that works. It's also going to turn people off who might want something more polished, that something that looks a bit better. But that's fine. You know, you can't be all things to all people. You've got to be true to yourself. And that's what I always say to anyone on, when they say, you know, what should I be doing on LinkedIn? What should I say? Should I get someone to write it for me? I don't know. Just do your own thing. Sure, if you want to get some help editing videos or polishing it up with someone that's a bit more technically competent than you are, that's fine. But just be yourself, say what you want to say. Don't feel like just because you've got a platform that's free, you need to be talking every single day. If you haven't got anything to say for a week, don't say anything for a week. And if one day you wake up and you've got 10 things you want to say, say all of them. You know, like, forget content calendars and over-strategizing. Just be yourself. And that's what I do. It works for me, and I see other people that do it in their own way, and it works for them. What I don't believe works is when someone's trying to be something they're not, trying to be too clever, has outsourced all of their content to be written by someone else. You know, you see that a mile off. Just stick to who you are and focus on it. And as you said, you know, people will listen to this and they'll either like me or they won't. And if they don't, that's fine. You know, it's you can't be there for everyone. But hopefully there'll be a couple of people that listen to him. I quite like his style and what he says. And that's fine too. It's the law of attraction.
Love it. Authenticity wins. Well, one thing I wanted to pick your brain on, Andrew, is like, look, you're quite clearly a humble person, and I'm making a lot of assumptions here, but I'm assuming that you've managed to make some form of decent amount of money over the course of your career. How have you sort of actively thought about wealth creation over your career? And the reason I ask is because a lot of people who listen to this are the ambitious type of people who are maybe like salespeople, they're making commission, they're making good money, but they want to understand how can I make millions, and how do I think about that now, and what do I need to do now to set myself up? How have you thought about that in your career?
I think, look, I was very lucky to make decent money at a relatively young age. We sold our agency when I was about 35, 36. And that put me in a position which changed my life. I'm not going to say I could retire and never work again, but I could certainly never have to worry about money. No debts, no, you know, just... So that was quite weird in a way.
Peace of mind.
You sort of think, and it's a nice problem to have, but where's the drive? Where's the motivation when actually, you know, if I wanted to take 5 years out and just chill on a beach, I could do that. But it didn't really... I think in some ways it made me realise that my driving force was not money, which is maybe easy to say once you've achieved it. But there always has to be progression. And you always have to feel, you know, in a way, money is the bit that validates why you work so hard. And whilst, you know, today, in all honesty, it makes zero difference to me whether I make £1 or £1 million, I don't think I'd be very happy with myself if I was putting in all these hours and I made £1 at the end of the year. It's about knowing your value, and I don't know how to answer this question really. I think you've always got to feel like you're progressing. You've always got to set yourself targets. And I always felt, you know, if you set yourself a target, a realistic target, and you focus on that, and you don't sort of at the beginning of a year say, this year I want to achieve this, get to the 31st of December and think, oh shit, I'm 50% short on it. You've got to keep monitoring it. But if you visualize that and you have a plan to get to that, you'll get there. It's sort of a manifestation. It's a strange thing. When I sort of stepped away from running an agency, I guess one of the hard things to do was, you know, when you're employed, which effectively I was because the company was owned by a PLC, I was earning a good salary, and it, you know, good month, bad month, go on holiday, be sick, that paycheck still came in at the end of the month. Suddenly, you got zero coming in. If I don't get out of bed, I don't make any money. If I go on holiday, I don't make any money. So I sort of, it didn't scare me because as I said, I was in quite a nice position where it was irrelevant. Like, thank God, you know, I don't mean this, it's sometimes a bit uncomfortable talking about money, but you know, I wasn't in a position where if I didn't make X, I couldn't pay a mortgage or couldn't pay the bills or couldn't take the kids to a nice holiday or something. It wasn't the case. But at the same time, I didn't want to just aimlessly sort of start doing my own thing. So I set myself a target that by the end of year one, I would earn there or thereabouts what I was earning in a in my salaried job with 20% more spare time. That's what I sort of set in my head. That would have been a good achievement. And I think I did that in about 3 months. And then it was like, well, what do I do now? Like, I don't really... So I was like, okay, well, you know, next year I'll try and increase that by 20%. And the next year, you know... Anyway, it's always about... And I still have those targets. And I still, in a funny sort of way, you know, when I have a shitty month, I don't beat myself up about it because it's irrelevant. But I'm a bit disappointed. You know, you do have to have targets. But now what I've realised... and it took me a long time to realise, is your biggest commodity is time. It really is, because that's the only thing that limits my capabilities, is time. And yeah, sure, you can work harder and harder and harder. Actually, you've got to work smarter. And when I started, generally I would charge, people would say, well, how much do you charge? And I'd sort of give them an hourly rate, and it was based on what I used to charge out to clients in my agency. I sort of upped that rate, because I could, and people were paying it, and I thought maybe I was too cheap. And until the point where my hourly rate was, you know, more than some of the best lawyers, doctors, accountants, professional service people in the country. And I was like, this is a bit weird, like, that's too much. But it wasn't a problem for people. And then suddenly one day, and I don't know what, probably listening to a podcast or reading something, I was listening to someone talking about just value. And it made me realise that years and years of experience means that I can get to ideas, get to solutions, get to decisions much, much quicker than someone who's just started out. But how do I value that? It doesn't seem right. If it takes me an hour to figure out something that would take someone else a week, why am I only being paid for an hour's time? So especially when it gets into creativity and things like that. You know, I can have an idea in the shower, on the toilet, going for a walk. But I can't, I'm not charging them for that amount of time. I'm charging them for the years of experience that allow me to get to that solution. So I stopped charging by hourly rates and I started charging by value. So if you said to me, can we spend a morning together and you'll help me with my business? And rather than say to you, okay, that will take 3.5 hours of my time at X pounds an hour, I would think about the value that I can bring your business. And that's how I would charge. And that's enabled me to increase my earning potential significantly. And if someone doesn't want to pay, they don't want to pay. Again, I'm not forcing anyone to work with me, but I back myself. So even if someone said to me, well, that's a lot of money, in my head I'd have already thought, am I confident I can make them a lot more money than it's going to cost them off the back of my help and my advice? And if the answer isn't yes, I won't have said yes to working with someone in the first place, or even put a proposal in. And I think that's important. And then, you know, the other thing that I've realized in these sort of last few years is about diversifying my income source. So, you know, I think we're not in an easy market. It is tough. And where you can get caught out is if you've got all your eggs in one basket. And for me, by having sort of diversified in terms of the types of services that I offer and the types of things that I do, it doesn't really matter if one bit isn't going so well, as long as the other bits are. And then I've taken sort of short-term and long-term ways to build money. So there's consultancy work that, you know, you're paid comes in at the end of the month. I've also taken sort of equity stakes in businesses,
yeah,
which, you know, may or may not come off. I've made investments in businesses that may or may not come off. I hope they do. I have sort of commission and referral deals where I'm not taking on the work, but I'll recommend someone who can. And that, you know, when that works, that money comes in and it's effectively sort of money while you sleep, because you're not actually having to work anymore to make that income. So there's all these different sources, and, you know, hopefully everything works and you don't have issues with any of it. But inevitably, there's always going to be one bit that is stronger than another at any moment in time.
Clear. So
I don't know if that
answers. It seems like the... No, it does. It seems like the way to amass at least some form of significant wealth is to focus your skills on one particular thing, so you get really fucking good at what you do. And then I guess to a point where you're a little bit more liquid, then you would look at like diversifying where your money comes from, different types of deals you have, different industries, etc. Because I'm assuming you probably made good money in the agency, but you said the exit is the thing that really impacted you. And so I think it speaks to people like ambitious.
Yeah. Right. When you exit, it gives you the chance to capitalize on all of the years of hard work. So when you're running a successful business, you know, if it's going well, you are making money year in, year out. You're hopefully being able to take dividends, and it's very nice. But all of a sudden, someone is looking at you from the outside in and placing a value on your business and giving you, you know, maybe 10 years worth of money on day one, guaranteed. Like that's the sort of recognition of all the effort and de-risking the future years. But not everyone has that opportunity to have that sort of life-changing event. But it did change my life. And it also, I think the biggest thing it did was, in a way, it relaxed me, because, you know, I was the breadwinner. I felt this pressure that I wanted to be able to give those around me the best lives that I could possibly offer. Yeah. Wanted to be able to provide education. I also had this sort of thing in my head. I don't know if I want to say this out loud, but I've started, so I'll say it anyway. My two boys, I wanted to be able to buy them properties, not necessarily to give to them, but that would give them a foot on the ladder somehow. Haven't figured it out yet. And if they're listening, please don't think you're getting a free house, because you're not. But I don't know why. It was just one of the things I wanted to do, was be able to buy two properties, and then there'd be, however I work it out, they're only, well, one of them's getting close to moving out. He's 20, the other's only 13. But I just wanted to have that for them. That was my sort of financial objective, which I was able to achieve. So what it did for me was, it just, there was no pressure, you know, as I said. And that's an amazing, privileged place to be, because sometimes I think if you're desperate in business and you're chasing the money, and that's where it all goes wrong. And when I, you know, going right back to what I was saying about just focus on the work, and you just said focus on one thing, focus on what you're good at, that is the key. And there were points in my career where I became a little bit too obsessed with the Excel spreadsheet, and every day I was looking at money. And I think once you start to lose the reason why you're doing it, the love for what you're doing, it does have an impact. And that's when I started to stop looking at it. But yeah, look, the key to it is find your strengths, find what you're good at, and the money will follow. You know, the reality is, in any profession, it's only really the top percentage, that top of the triangle, that are earning really, really decent money. We've all got to get to that point. And don't worry too much about a number, a target. Just constantly be moving forward and making progression, and you'll get there. And I'm a big believer, you need three things to be successful. Number one, find something that you're good at. Number two, work hard. And number three, a bit of luck. Because, you know, you can work really hard, but if you're no good at what you do, you're never going to get to that top of the triangle. You can be really, really brilliant, but not work hard. And I'm definitely believe nothing comes without a bit of hard graft. And sometimes you can be good at what you can do, you can work really hard, but you just don't get that break. And some people say, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. I do think that that's true, but I also think you have to have the ability to spot luck and spot opportunities. And there's some people in life who just, you know, they're good at what they do, they work hard, but an opportunity comes their way and they're just, they don't necessarily see it and capitalise on it, or they let it pass them by. You've got to be able to spot those moments in time. And without doubt, I've got lucky in my career on many, many occasions. And as I've matured and developed my own personal skills, I think I've got better at spotting what those lucky opportunities are. But I think you need those three factors, and you have to be self-aware, and if things aren't working for you, you've got to figure out why and shift them so that they do.
You know, it's refreshing to hear someone as no BS and as direct as you talk about serendipity, or as you termed it, luck, manifestation, law of attraction, because people have these sort of woo-woo type of associations with them, but ultimately they're just the result of you doing the graph, right, as you put it, doing the hard graph. And focus on the right things and being self-aware, etc. So I absolutely love that take. One thing I want to finish on, Andrew, is something positive and hopefully borrow your insights here as well. What are you excited about over the next 6 to 12 months? What's going on in your world at the moment that you're particularly passionate about or excited about?
Good question. For me, that's a really boring answer, but it's kind of more of the same. I think the business is going really well. The economy, I think, has been tough the last year or so, but there's 100% green shoots and confidence coming back in. So for me, you know, there's some M&A deals that I'm working on, which will hopefully reach conclusion by the end of the year. There's some exciting charity stuff that I'm working on, I'm looking forward to. My new sort of investment in Stacked, I think that's given me a bit of a passion for startups, and there's four businesses within that group who I want to see succeed. AAR is really building in terms of, I think, in tougher economic times, clients do need the advice and the help, and we're doing some really interesting work, running some interesting processes there. Looking forward to the new apprentice winner, my 18th apprentice winner, and setting up their business with them. Working on some exciting stuff with Lord Sugar, which I can't really talk about, but there's some big stuff happening for him. He's a man that never ever slows down, so it's been a good inspiration to me. So loads and loads, and you know, genuinely, I want to make sure I don't lose focus on that balance bit, and I'm equally looking forward to spending a summer doing as little as possible and spending time with my kids, my girlfriend, my family. You know, that's just as important as any of the work, probably more important, to be honest, than any of the work stuff. But bottom line is I find that question difficult to answer, because as long as I'm still enjoying what I'm doing, I don't really care.
Makes sense. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time, and I found you incredibly vulnerable, direct, honest. Some of your takes, I can already sort of, my brain's already going at how you've helped me in my current situation. So thank you for that. And yeah, I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, Andrew. There we go. You're still there, mate.
Still there.